On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
We're facing a very important election in American history this November. But there's actually a bigger issue at stake even than any one particular election. The issue is, who are we as a people? What do we expect? And what are we willing to sacrifice in order to keep freedom going in the American Republic? To talk to us today is Oz Guinness, the author of A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom and the American Future from InterVarsity Press. Mr. Guinness is the author or editor of more than 25 books, including The American Hour, The Great Experiment, Time for Truth, and The Case for Civility, some of which have been reviewed on BookBits. He's the great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness, the Dublin brewer, was born in China during World War II, where his parents were medical missionaries. He witnessed the Chinese Revolution in 1949, was expelled with many other foreigners in 1951, returned to Europe, completed his Doctor of Philosophy in the Social Sciences at Oxford, and in the 1960s was a leader at Labre, an evangelical Christian organization founded by Francis Schaeffer. In 84, he came to the United States, and he lives here now as a guest scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Studies and a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. In 1991, he founded the Trinity Forum. And he brings an interesting perspective to us because he is from another country, born in a different country, grew up in a different country, and has come to our country. And I found his remarks challenging and enlightening. And so I'm really delighted to welcome Oz Guinness to be with us today on the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Many Americans automatically assume that because we're free now, as we define freedom, then we'll always be free. And they don't necessarily look at the restrictions that have been imposed on us during the War on Terror as a permanent situation, the surveillance of civilians and so forth. And they seem to assume that because we're free, there'll always be an America. You, as a man from Great Britain, born in China, you have some wisdom in that regard as far as the fact that no empire lasts forever.
Well, as you know, I'm not American, but I'm a great admirer of this country. But one of the things your founders were incredibly clear about was that free societies don't last. And there's a paradox underlying freedom, that the greatest enemy of freedom is freedom itself. So times of power and prosperity, which America has experienced recently, are the times when people forget and they think the freedom they enjoy is going to go on forever. And I think we need to go back to the realism and the wisdom of the framers to understand why it doesn't and to understand the system they put into place to try and make sure that it could. And what I argue, as you know, is that the most daring and brilliant thing about the framers was their idea that you could create a free society that could stay free forever. No one had ever done it, but they thought they had the system.
If we look at history, at world history, and we see the great empires through history, there is a common thread, and not the usual one that most casual commentators make, that, well, of course, they rose, they fell, they had these particular things in common. Rome was once a republic, then it became an empire, and so forth. But the point you make in your book, A Free People's Suicide, is that every empire has a beginning and an end because of what they start doing to themselves. That it wasn't really the barbarians who destroyed Rome as much as it was Rome allowing itself to kind of rot from the inside out. And that's part of the warning and the challenge that you bring to us in the book.
Well, absolutely. And the book title actually goes back to Abraham Lincoln, who said, as a nation of free men, we must live free forever or die by our own hand, die by suicide. In other words, strong, free people bring themselves down. It won't be the Nazis or the Soviets or Osama bin Laden, and today, of course, is the commemoration of 9/11. It will be Americans themselves. So I argue the problem isn't wolves at the door. The problem is termites in the floor. And that's what we're seeing today. Americans are careless and sometimes opposed to the system that the framers put in place to keep freedom going.
One of the points that you make in the book is that Americans today seem obsessed with consumerism And this is an example of internal freedom. That you're free to spend your money on whatever you want, no matter how nonsensical it is, no matter how unnecessary it is. And we become a nation of debtors precisely because we want, and we think we have to have it immediately. And we spend money that we don't have in order to have things.
No, that's right. And it's just one of the many forces bringing down freedom. Let's go back to the framers' understanding. If freedom doesn't last, they put in place, they didn't give a name for what they put in place. I call it the golden triangle of freedom. Alexis de Tocqueville, he called it the habits of the heart. But the three legs of the triangle are easily said. Freedom requires virtue. Virtue requires faith. Faith requires freedom. And like the recycling triangle, it goes round and round. Now, each of those legs is either misunderstood, neglected, or sometimes openly opposed today. So modern Americans are actually rejecting the system the framers put in place. But as you say, we don't have anything to replace it. And things like consumerism are just corrupting the freedom we do have.
Now, let's talk about, to me, consumerism is sort of a perfect example of virtue gone wild. People are virtuous. They don't just rush out and get things that they want. They get things that they need, and they're willing to work hard and save for them. And yet, Americans right now seem to be perfectly willing to be very careless with our money, not just as individuals, but as a nation. We're spending money that we don't have. We're borrowing money. We're selling bonds, and other nations are buying them up. Whereas, say, during World War II, we funded our war in two ways, by direct taxes and by war bonds. Now we seem to be funding the war on terror by just selling stock in America and not thinking about the long-term repercussions of that decision.
Yeah, now you put it well. It was always understood in the traditional times or classical ages that people in debt are less free. The more debt you have, the less freedom to move you have. And yet, since the 1950s, really, we've had this consumer boom that is a debt leverage boom, and now we realize we're incredibly in debt. And so you put it well. But I'd go back to the very definition of freedom itself. You know, Lord Acton put it rightly, that freedom is not the permission to do what you like. It's the power to do what you ought. Now, to do what we ought, we have to know who we are and the truth of who we are and the truth of the right ways of living, and that's all gone today. So another way of putting it is, Isaiah Berlin, the great Jewish philosopher at Oxford, whom I remember, he said freedom is both negative and positive. So negative freedom is freedom from oppression, from chains, from addiction, whatever it is. We all need that. But positive freedom is freedom for, freedom to be. And the trouble in America today is all the freedom is freedom from, negative freedom. And so people want the government off our backs or away from my body, as the liberals put it. But no one has any idea what the freedom to be should be, what it means to be free citizens. So there's an incredible chaos of freedom, and it's just becoming another word for permissiveness and license. And freedom like that will only undermine itself.
We're talking to Oz Guinness, who is the author of A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom and the American Future, from InterVarsity Press. Oz is the author or editor of more than 25 books, frequent speaker, prominent social critic, founder of the Trinity Forum, who has been a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, as well as a guest scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Studies. You make the point in the book about American revolution against Great Britain in the 18th century would not have been possible if Americans didn't already have a certain level of freedom. When you look at Spanish colonies, for example, and see how they have turned out after they declared their independence and fought revolutions, Mexico, for example, has fought one revolution after another trying to figure out what does it mean for them to be a free and independent state. The United States had a great leg up, just like Canada and Australia and New Zealand. We understood what freedom was like. We wanted to be freer from any outside decision-making.
Now, again, you're right. The American colonists were probably the freest people in the world at the time. So they went from relative freedom to what they wanted as greater freedom, and I understand that fully. you know, I tell the story in the book of Captain Levi Preston, who was asked by a young researcher, and Preston was a veteran of Lexington and Concord, and the researcher asked him, why did you go out to fight? Were you oppressed? And he said, no, we were oppressed. And the fact is, they knew they had been incredibly free, and they wanted more freedom. Now, I'm, of course, Anglo-Irish, and I would have to say, as an Englishman, that many of the American ideas were English ideas, but they came and flowered in this country, as sadly they never did in England. But the great challenge for the framers was not just how you won freedom, how you ordered freedom, and the founders did that brilliantly. The challenge was how you sustained freedom, or as they put it, how you perpetuated freedom. And that's what Americans today forget. You think that once you've got freedom, it lasts forever. Freedom never, ever lasts forever. And so I think Americans today need to go back and say, are we really doing what's necessary to sustain freedom? For example, it used to be clearly understood that in a free society, everybody's born free, but not everyone's immediately equal to it. They have to be educated for liberty. They need to be taught what it is to be a free citizen. And that's part of what's called civic education. But really, since the 1960s, civic education has died in America. And all the political leaders, they talk about this, that, and the other in mediocre education, but they hardly ever talk about civic education and education for citizenship. And that's a huge mistake.
I have a student in a class that I teach at the university who is of Turkish ancestry but was born and raised in Germany. And because her parents are from Turkey, she had to be 25 years old before she could even apply to become a citizen of Germany, even though she was actually born on German soil.
Which, really?
Yeah, and that that was interesting to me because, of course, here in America, we have just the opposite. If people come here from other countries and they have a baby here, the baby is automatically a citizen by dint of being born on American soil, even if the parents are not. This has also been kind of an issue in the problems with wild amounts of illegal immigration over the last couple of decades, too, that we have what we call anchor babies. And if they're not old enough to take care of themselves, do we deport the parents who are illegals back to their home country? Who takes care of the child? Can we deport an American citizen just because they're underage?
But, you know, the trouble with all the citizenship debate and the immigration debate is that no one mentions civic education. And I lived in Washington nearly 30 years now, and I've heard people talking about border control and English as a second language and the pathway to citizenship and all that sort of stuff. No one mentions civic education. America could actually take a lot more people if, when they arrive, it taught them what it is to be American.
Yes.
And as one historian put it, it's relatively easy today to get your papers to become an American, but increasingly difficult to know what it is to be American. And that's the real issue.
And that's the issue that you raise in the book, actually, is what does it mean for us as Americans to be Americans? What does that require of us? What does that mean for our understanding of how to carry it forward? Because as you point out in the book, freedom is really one generation at a time. Just because my parents were free doesn't mean necessarily that I'm going to be free or that my children or grandchildren are going to be automatically free, because things can change in the meantime.
No, that's exactly right. The great French theorist Montesquieu put it like this. You can have the best structures of liberty in the world, and that's things like the Constitution and the laws. But freedom is kept alive not just by the structures of liberty, but by the spirit of liberty in the hearts of citizens. And without that, well, that has to be carried on from generation to generation. And you can see that's not happening today. I'll put it another way. America's motto, A Pluribus Unum, is also America's greatest achievement. Out of extraordinary diversity, you created one great nation. In other words, a pluribus unum. But the tragedy today is many Americans have no idea what the unum is. What are the first principles that all Americans hold in common? And I often go in groups, whether Christian groups in churches or student groups in campuses or even sometimes business groups, and ask them, put down a piece of paper, 10 things that you believe are part of the American unum. hardly anyone can get beyond one or two.
Mm.
And you can see today that it's simply not taught. Well, as Sam Huntington used to say, if that continues, soon the revolution will put less stamp on America than the immigration.
Mm.
And America will no longer be the American Republic, but just a big, strong, powerful nation that's lost the core of what it once was, including freedom.
You know, I can remember taking civics classes. It was required to take one semester of civics when I was in high school. But when my kids came through, they went to a private school, and so they had civics. But in the public schools, civics was no longer a required course, even for just a half a year. And that bothered me a lot. And I see why it should bother me, that if people don't understand what it means, what is the separation of this and that, and what are the three branches of government? What's the checks and balances? If people don't know what the checks and balances are, then they're not going to understand that it's a one branch trying to impose its authority on another. Why I should be upset when the president makes laws or the Supreme Court makes laws. Because they don't realize it's the job of the legislature to make laws.
No, you're exactly right. And we have current things like, say, the assaults on religious freedom. And as people have debated this, you realize they haven't a clue what religious freedom means, where it came from, and why it's important. So I've many times heard people say, well, religious liberty is just liberty for the religious. That's nonsense. It's a matter of freedom of conscience for people of all faiths, whether religious or naturalistic, supernatural or naturalistic. And you can see today there's a huge amount of ignorance around. So even senior members of this administration were talking of religious liberty as freedom of worship. Well, every tin pot dictator gives you freedom of worship. In other words, the space between your ears when you have your mouth shut, you can believe what you like, but
right.
That is not religious liberty. That's not what Madison called the free exercise, which America is about. So there's an incredible confusion and neglect and misunderstanding about many of the first things of the American experiment, and that's very dangerous.
I want to get back to your golden triangle again and talking about virtue. You tell a great story that I had heard before about Washington. He had the opportunity toward the end of the Revolution, when we had more or less won the war, to become the king. I'm not going to say anything more because I'd like you to tell this. This is a great story.
Well, it's a wonderful story. Congress hadn't paid the army, so the army was restless and on the edge of mutiny, and there was extraordinary chaos. And, you know, the Articles of Confederation simply didn't work very well. And so the army wanted to start all over again and ask Washington to be King George I of America. And they knew he didn't like the plan, so they met in secret. He stumbled in on them, and he tries three lines of attack to try and change their minds, and each of them fail. And some of them are very good arguments. I've been with you. In Clinton's words, I felt your pain. But each time he tried, they were stony in their response. And then he gets out a letter from a congressman to read to them, and he couldn't read it in the light. So he took out what they'd never seen before. The great general had glasses. I thought glasses were very rare in those days. And he mutters apologetically, I have grown gray and old in the service of our country. But seeing him put on those glasses just reduced the whole tent to tears. And he won them over in a few seconds. Now, some people say it was contrived. I personally think it was natural. But the point is, he swung them against kingship. And every revolution, except the American one, has produced a vacuum into which a strong man has strode, and they've gone the way of tyranny. So England in the Civil War produced Cromwell. The French produced Robespierre. The Soviets produced Lenin and Stalin. You could go on. America has none of those tyrants. And it goes back to the character of George Washington, who, when he was offered the crown, refused that power. And, of course, after his years as president, he resigned and headed back to Mount Vernon. And all of that goes back to his great character. And that is part of the virtue which he himself spoke about so strongly.
And this was a virtue that those who came after him understood very well. I read a book several years ago that said that the year 1800 was the most amazing election in the history of the world. And I thought, well, that seems a little much. Just one country, and America wasn't that important a country in those days. But the point they made was it was the first time that you had someone who was in a position of authority who got defeated by somebody else who had been their friend and now was their bitter enemy. And yet, when it came time, Adams did not hold on to the presidency. He willingly stepped aside and let Jefferson take over as the third president. Despite their personal animosity, Adams knew that the institution was larger than his hurt feelings.
Yeah, now that's incredibly important. But sadly, that first leg, freedom requires virtue, is roundly attacked today. So I remember at the time of Clinton's impeachment, you know, a number of scholars wrote to the New York Times saying, in effect, it doesn't matter if the president has no character. All that matters is the president competent? And actually, you can just take the history of the American presidency by itself to show that is dangerously wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For example, I use the example of President Nixon, who was one of my friends, was high up in his administration. But he was famous for not only believing in IQ, intelligence quotient, he believed in what he called CQ, character quotient. And yet his presidency was brought down by the character of the principals in his administration, including his own. If he had not been so paranoid, if Henry Kissinger had not been so vain, if Alexander Haig had not been so suffering from hubris, he would have had a very different presidency, and Watergate, for example, probably wouldn't have happened.
And it would have changed the political landscape for America for decades to come, because the fallout from Watergate still reverberates in the halls of Congress. We still have this idea that we don't dare trust each other because the government is doing something sneaky behind our backs.
That's right. From Watergate downwards, right down to humbler things like the crisis of the family, we've bred a generation. It's often said that the millennials, the younger generation, are the cynical generation. And you can see that ever since Watergate, there's mm-hmm. a huge amount about which to be cynical, sadly.
Yeah. You also make the point in the book, A Free People's Suicide, from InterVarsity Press, embracing hubris is not the way to really lead. And you point out that whenever America has overstepped its bounds and tried to impose what it feels like is the right way to do things on other countries without asking for their permission to actually do these things and out asking any of our allies around the world if they'd like to be involved in it, that's when we have drawn condemnation and dissension in the ranks, particularly in Europe, which is a terribly sad thing. I don't know.
Again, you're exactly right. Hubris, as the Greeks understood it, was not just pride. It was the illusion of invulnerability, which overweening pride brought on. And I personally was appalled. As you know, I'm British.
Right.
But after the Soviet Union fell, you got many people, including many scholars, saying that the power of America was unprecedented, unparalleled, the greatest power on earth since Rome, and maybe even greater than Rome. Well, not too many years later, that looks exceedingly foolish. I mean, the British Empire actually covered one-third of the earth.
Yes.
And you can see how short-lived a lot of that hubris has been. And today in the global era, sadly, America has a sense of weakening power and is increasingly, in many of the international discussions, irrelevant. Now, I think America has to speak much more humbly. You take, say, the notion of exceptionalism. As historians say, every single superpower, and there are probably more than 70 of them in human history, has each claimed that they were exceptional. What would be really exceptional would be for a superpower to say that it was not exceptional. And yet America still harps on about its exceptionalism. And much of this, sadly, is foolish. And there needs to be a new realism, a new humility. This is a great, great country. And it has a lot to share with the world. I myself think that the American way of settling religion and public life. Madison was right when he called it the true remedy. And yet for 50 years, America's been squabbling in the culture wars. And now when the whole world needs the best of the American way, America's not showing the best of its way. And so the world's not really interested. So I'm a great admirer of this country, but I think America at its best could be the answer to so many of the world's questions, but she's not at her best today.
It concerns me that we have corporations like Google that have publicly insisted that they're going to spend millions of dollars trying to encourage other countries to embrace gay marriage, for example. I'm thinking, of all the things we really need to worry about in the world, with all the issues there are and all the dangers there are, is this really what America wants to be seen around the world as the nation that promotes gay marriage, or as a nation that promotes promiscuous sex? One wonders if the Muslims got tired of America first because they decided we weren't really much of a Christian nation anymore, considering the kind of image that we have abroad.
Well, as you know, that's actually not part of my book.
That's true.
But you're right. What we've seen is a revolution, a social revolution, one of the fastest in all history, which has been brought in with very shaky scientific underpinnings and really without any strong, good democratic debate. And now we're at the place, I mean, you mentioned Google, you could mention Starbucks, or on the other side, obviously, Chick-fil-A, where anyone who disagrees with anything is immediately charged with words like homophobia or whatever, just to silence debate. And it's another example, the culture wars is another one. America has lost the tough-minded, robust debate that we need in the public square if this nation is to go forward well. There are huge issues to be debated. And I wish things like freedom and sustainable freedom were part of that debate. And I watched a lot, or a good part of, the convention in Tampa and the convention in Charlotte, but they didn't really debate many of the deep issues. And someone said about the Tampa convention, it was more Pat Boone than Winston Churchill. And I must say, having been born under Winston Churchill and growing up under him as a boy, and I met him when I was a teenager, there was very little of his great analysis, historical overview, pithy realism, things like that. And I just wish we had leaders who really addressed the real state of the union, because America is in deep trouble at the moment. Yeah. And the issues need to be addressed. And I also believe in the possibility of renewal. I'm not a pessimist, but the issues have to be addressed at their core.
Well, certainly you've given us a lot to think about, and there's a lot more in his book. I really highly encourage people to pick up a copy of A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom and the American Future from InterVarsity Press, which goes into much greater detail and much better analysis than I've been able to give you about his book. And Oz Guinness, we appreciate so much you taking time to talk to us today. Are there websites that people could go to find more information about the book, or places to order, or anything like that?
Well, you can go to ozguinness.com, or you can get the book on amazon.com quite easily. But really a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
I always enjoy reading your books. I always learn a lot, and I always get challenged, and I think that's what makes for a really good book, something that doesn't leave you the same as when you first picked it up.
Oh, thank you. Great to be with you. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. God bless. Bye-bye.
To understand more of what it means to be an American and to understand what we as a nation have to do, regardless of who's elected in November, to be a strong nation with strong virtues and faith in order to keep our freedom, be sure to pick up a copy of Oz Guinness's A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom and the American Future from InterVarsity Press. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station for On the Bookshelf. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks so much for listening, and God bless. On the Bookshelf, copyrighted by Kirby Creative Services, Inc., used by permission of Troy Broadcasting Corporation.